is not just a place where it's world famous for its cheese, although it certainly deserves that. In the ancient past, there were four known civilizations that rose and fell before the United States on our continent. This is not theory. This isn't New Age silly stuff. Archaeologists are aware of these four civilizations that were highly advanced for their time. They made fabulous structures. They excelled in everything from building stone pyramids to being great in dentistry and everything in between. They introduced farming to our continent. These civilizations left their imperishable mark on our landscape here. And these civilizations rose and fell. And when they fell, they absolutely vanished. They took everybody with them, just like the Titanic going down. And Wisconsin played a major role in the history of these three of these four civilizations. I shouldn't say all four, three of them. And the civilization that left its really most obvious mark on the state of Wisconsin was people known as the Hope Well. And that is an archaeological term. It doesn't mean we understand the real name of these people, what they called themselves. The name Hopewell comes from a farm owned by a Mr. Hopewell in Ohio, where this culture was first recognized. And these people, we refer to them as the Hopewell, live from about, they made their impact, rather, on North America from about 300 B.C. until 400 A.D. They absolutely vanished away at 400 A.D. They vanished away because they were killed off. It was a war of extermination that took place. But before that tragic event, the Hopewell were particularly interested in landscape artistry. And we're not talking about just crude mounds here or heaps of earth. We're talking about magnificent earth sculptures, some on a huge scale, unbelievably huge scale, and others representing, well, animals that are not supposed to be known here in North America before modern times, such as the elephant, for example. And there were at least 10,000 of these magnificent earth sculptures in Wisconsin alone. They were mostly concentrated in Wisconsin. We know about these 10,000 sculptures, earth sculptures, because they were personally surveyed by a man by the name of T.S. Lewis, who devoted his entire life, in other words, about 30 years of mapping and surveying and documenting these earth sculptures. And the reason he did that was because they were all being wiped out by the farming that was taking place at that time, clearing the land and so forth. And unfortunately, these earth sculptures were being obliterated literally before his eyes. And T.S. Lewis was able to get funding so that for about a little under 30 years, he traveled throughout the state of Wisconsin and other states, but mostly Wisconsin. And it's a shame that this man is really not known outside of academia today. He died virtually impoverished, but he left all of his drawings, all of his work, at the Minnesota Historical Society, and you can go there and see them today. And it's quite eye-opening, the level of artistry that was put into these earth mounds. Very great sculptures. If they would be preserved today in their pristine condition, they'd be world-class works of art. And these great landscapers, the Hopewell, they, for example, give you just a... It's hard to describe, of course, just in mere words without seeing these things, but to give you an idea, around Lake Mendota in Madison, Wisconsin, there still exists partially an eagle mound. It is the largest representation of its kind in the world. It's 2 miles long. It's so huge that it cannot be seen from the ground, and there are no high prominences around it. Yet it is so superbly laid out that it represents this great eagle in flight. There were several eagle mounds around Lake Mendota, and for some reason the Hopewell chose that area to specifically represent the eagle. And they were just immense, just huge. There are other mounds which are not quite as large, but also cannot be seen from the ground, and there are no high areas around to look down on them. So why would anybody go to the trouble of making these magnificent sculptures that you cannot appreciate? Now we're entering into theory here. One way you can appreciate the Eagle Mound, or you could have when it was in its pristine condition, is if you are in literally a meditative state, where you know you're in a sacred place. And let's say nobody tells you what this mound is, and you can't figure it out by just looking at this sculpted little hill. But if you walk around the mound, and you follow its outline, a kind of an image begins to appear in the mind, believe it or not. And it might form in the mind, you say, oh, I'm walking around an eagle. Now that's an interesting kind of a religious experience. However, Native Americans will tell you that there's another explanation for those mounds, that these mounds were used for multiple purposes, just the same as architecture is used today for multiple purposes. Now, the Sears Tower in Chicago houses a television station, and it has many all different types of offices. It has all kinds of reception areas and so forth. In other words, it has multiple purposes. The same thing with these ancient sculptures, ancient structures. And one of the purposes, according to the Oneida Indians, who will tell you about these sculptures, is that they were used as schools for shamans. And what the shaman would do is he would bring his initiates, his students, after they'd reached a certain level of proficiency in their psychic abilities. We call them psychic abilities. Previous generations have referred to them as spiritual powers. Native Americans, some Native American tribes, refer to it as Wanaka, which means the power, the spiritual power.
Wanaka.
And the shaman would take his initiates to these mounds, which are very amorphous. You can't tell them. You can't tell what they are. And he would have them astral project. What that means is that they would extend their consciousness far outside of their bodies, and then from this high prominence would look down. And if the student would say, I astral projected my body and I looked down, I saw this enormous eagle, then the shaman would know that he had passed the test and that he was telling the truth. Now, that was told to me by an Oneida shaman himself about 15 years ago. I heard that also from other Native American elders in the state of Wisconsin. So that's one purpose for having these there. There are other purposes, and that was most Native American tribes were led by two men. Sometimes a woman was involved. Women were not excluded, but it was mostly men. And the one chief was responsible for warfare and for politics and hunting and all the usual mundane things. And the other leader was a shaman, and the shaman would determine things, for example, like where a tribe would settle. And a tribe would settle in an area not just because, there's good hunting here or there's good fishing around. Those were, of course, important things to consider. But the shaman had the final say. He was a reader of the landscape. He referred to, many tribes refer to them as readers. The name shaman is not a Native American term. That's a Siberian term that we use. Well, they would call them like readers of the land, readers of the landscape. And they would say, there is spiritual power here. There's a concentration of spiritual power. And they would be able to not only identify that that spiritual power exists in a certain spot, but the type of spiritual power. These, after all, were experts in their field. And then they would have, the shaman would then have the people of his tribe make a mound, either just a heap of earth or sometimes sculpt it into a particular animal shape. And these were not just done for aesthetic reasons, although that's part of it. Of course, they're very beautiful, magnificent, but it was done to characterize the type of spiritual power involved in a particular sacred site. Now, this is interesting because it explains why archaeology, strict archaeology, university archaeology, is at a total loss to explain why these mounds were made, why so many were made, and what they represent. And that's because archaeology is very good at surveying things, and trying to get the dates of things, who made them, and so forth. But and those are important things. But if you want to understand why these things were made, how they really functioned, you must include the spiritual dimension. They don't work unless you include the spiritual side. And that's unfortunate for this reason, that archaeologists do not include the spiritual. It's part of the scientific method that you exclude any kind of spiritual ideas. And so by doing that, it's unfortunate, you can't really get at it. But Wisconsin has still some of these mounds that are left. Some of them are in pristine condition. You can go and visit some of these magnificent things. Some of them were oriented to various celestial phenomena, particularly having to do with the sun. And it's possible that the Eagle Mounds around Lake Mendota were solar-oriented. The reason why we think so is because you can go to a place outside of Milwaukee today, just northwest of Milwaukee, and this site contains some of the best preserved of all of these mounds, and there's a large bird mound, it could be an eagle, that is oriented to the sunset on the summer solstice. The vernal equinox. I'm sorry, the vernal equinox. In other words, the first day of spring. So there does appear to be some kind of a solar relationship between these winged eagles, mostly, and the sun. That's interesting because in other parts of the world, the eagle is associated with the sun. All over through the Greco-Roman world, down amongst the Aztecs and the Maya, the eagle is associated with time and with the sun. So you see the same thing at work here in ancient Wisconsin. It's a marvelous landscape. If we could have, beyond the preservation that we have in the drawings and the surveying of T.S. Lewis, if we had the mounds restored fully today, it would be just a remarkable landscape that you would see. There were representations not only of birds, but of seals. That's very peculiar. Matter of fact, some of the mounds are very specific. You can identify the type of animal very easily. They're just like almost photographic representations, outlines of the animal. Others are more generic. Some of the bird mounds are referred to as eagle mounds. Some of the animal mounds are referred to as panther mounds. They're not really eagles or panthers. They just represent the spirit of flight or the animal spirit itself. But others are extremely well detailed. And this one of a seal, for example, which no longer exists, was plowed out of existence, is remarkable because it represents a type of seal which is nowhere near Wisconsin. It's an Arctic seal. Now, what are people in Wisconsin doing that are making this representation of an Arctic seal? The most controversial of all, the earth mounds.
Where did they find an Arctic seal?
In one of the large mounds in Wisconsin.
You don't know where?
Yes, it's no longer exists.
But
out of existence. But its coordinates and its exact location were preserved by T.S. Lewis. I think that one was in the northwest part of the state, if I'm not incorrect.
Okay.
Other mounds are not representing animals at all. The ones that represent animals are referred to as bioglyphs or as effigy mounds, generally speaking. Other mounds are geometric shapes. Some of them are magnificent crosses, huge crosses, giant crosses. Not too many of those, but there are some of those. The most controversial of all of these mounds, though, however, are the elephant mounds. And there were dozens of them. Now, T.S. Lewis was a professional surveyor. His work is still highly regarded by archaeologists because he preserved all this work that's gone. And amongst these mounds that he drew, there are, I would say, if not a dozen, close to a dozen, which unquestionably represent elephants. And what Lewis did is he didn't write about the mounds so much. He just really documented them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he'll say, well, here's a mound. It looks like an eagle very distinctly. Or here, this one, I don't know what it represents, and this one is elephants. And if you go to the Minnesota Historical Society and you request to see their microfilm copies of his work, I actually got a chance to see his real work, not even the microfilm. They showed me his hand drawings, his hand surveying, and there's no question that these represent elephants. Not only do they represent elephants, they represent a specific type of elephants, the East Asian elephants. These are not African elephants at all.
They were actually Asian elephants?
They're Asian elephants that are represented.
Because I always thought that maybe possibly they were representing mammoths.
No, No, these are not mammoths. No, these are not mammoths. They're East Asian elephants. They're identifiable East Asian elephants. You can tell by the cranium and by the way the ears are. The ears are smaller. The cranium is more bumpy. It's definitely East Asian elephants. There's actually a line of these African or these Asian elephants that are portrayed not far from the Mississippi, down by St. Croix. And they, some of them probably still exist. There are a couple of Native Americans that are trying to find them right now. As a matter of fact, they're looking in that area for these elephants. So it's remarkable. Here we have a people, 2,000 years ago or more, who are creating these masterfully surveyed mounds, effigy mounds, all across the state of Wisconsin. 10,000 of them known, probably almost certainly more, and among them are elephants. Now, if there was just one, you'd figure, like, well, maybe somebody slipped, you know, or just a chance it could be something else, but not when you've got a dozen or more.
We've also found in Wisconsin horse mounds, right?
Yes. The reason I hesitate is because that mound is extremely interesting. It shows a, that no longer exists. It shows what appears to be a horse, could be. I don't know what else it could. It doesn't look exactly like it, but it looks very close to it. But what's remarkable about this one, it was 80 feet long, if I remember correctly. Beautifully done. It looks certainly looks like a horse. But at its hooves, where its hooves are supposed to be, are wheels. It looks like a wheeled horse. Is it a Trojan horse? I don't know, but that is remarkable.
That is interesting. Wouldn't that be something, a Trojan horse, huh?
Well, it represents a wheeled horse. And it is a mound that was at least, 1,600 years old. And here amongst the people that supposedly knew nothing of the wheel either. But it's definitely, I mean, if you look at anybody that would look at this thing without knowing anything about it, they say, well, that's a wheeled horse.
And where was that found at?
That one was found, interestingly, now that is interesting too. That was found about around Fort Atkinson. Now, what's interesting about that is not far from Fort Atkinson is Rock Lake, of course, and out between Rock Lake and Fort Atkinson, more towards Rock Lake, there was a mound. That was just an ordinary mound. It wasn't anything to really look at. It looked like an ancient mound, though, and it was on this farmer's property. The farmer eventually plowed it away, and he found inside this mound, it was definitely an Indian mound. They're all over that area, but this one so it wasn't particularly outstanding. But he found the burial of a horse, a horse buried in this mound. Now, I know that for sure because it was told to me by Professor James Scherz, who is Professor Emeritus at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He visited the farmer. He saw the bones. The farmer is not letting the bones out of his sight. And it was definitely excavated on this guy's farm. Horse bone. Now, of course, we're told, of course, that the horse did not exist in North America until it was brought by the Spanish in the, 17th century, I guess. And here we're finding an Indian mound that's about 2,000 years old. That has the bones of clearly a horse, a skull, and the bone. The whole thing is there. It looked like it looked as though the horse had been interred in an honorable fashion. That's what Professor Scherz said. It looked like it had not just fallen in or something, or they just shoved
it up to earth. Professor, how are you spelling that?
S C H E R Z.
S C H
E R Z.
E R Z.
You can Google him. As a matter of fact, he's quite a prominent archaeologist. He was professor of civil engineering at the University of Wisconsin for many years, and a very brilliant creature. He's a superb surveyor himself.
Now, why do you feel, you wrote a book on Atlantis in Wisconsin. How do you feel the connection with Atlantis in Wisconsin?
This way, there was one of the greatest mysteries of archaeology. It's so great, as a matter of fact, archaeologists don't talk about it, is the copper mining that took place a long time ago. It is a fact that beginning around 3000 BC, in other words, when Egypt was new, when Egypt had just been founded, ancient Egypt. Around 3000 BC, a massive copper mining enterprise erupted all across the Great Lakes region, the Upper Great Lakes region, specifically at Isle Royale in Michigan, along the shores of Wisconsin, Lake Superior. The amount of copper removed is absolutely staggering. A conservative, ultra-conservative estimate, and now this estimate really has been pretty well put by the boards, is that between 3000 BC and 1200 BC, something like half a billion pounds of this copper was mined and removed by a totally unknown people. Now, that estimate of half a billion pounds is probably, more realistic, is probably close to twice that amount. The mines for this copper mining enterprise have been known about for, must be going on 200 years now, well over 150 years archaeologists have known about it. The mines themselves, if you can go visit them to this day, go to Isle Royale, and they will have a map for you at the ranger station that will show you where some of these mines are. There are hundreds and hundreds of these mines still exist. They're pit mines. They're all dug vertically, right through down to about 60 feet or so. And they removed this copper because it was the highest grade copper on Earth. You won't find any better copper in the world, except up the Isle Royale and the Upper Great Lakes region. The reason is because the copper is very pure, and it has flecks of gold and silver in it. And so somebody removed prodigious amounts. Now, the enigma is this. This mining took place from 3000 BC to 1200 BC. Huge mining operation. I think if you took all of the pit mines together, I think if you took all the pit mines together, they're all like about 8 to 10 feet wide. You put them all together, they would form a trench something like over 5 miles long. Some of the machines, actual machines these people use, still exist. They're very crude. They're not powered by electricity or anything like that. But at the bottom of one of these pit mines was found a kind of an accordion device. And it's believed, archaeologists tell us, that huge amounts of copper in the form of nuggets weighing tons were placed on top of this wooden accordion device made out of logs. And then levers were used to literally shoot this thing to the top of the pit mine, which was about 60 feet below the surface. Yeah, literally millions of beautifully made hammer stones made out of diorite, very strong, tough rock, have been found all over Isle Royale, all around the Great Lakes. This is left from the miners. Now, what's interesting about this mining enterprise is these people didn't bring this copper out for kicks. At the same time, if you look at other parts of the world, what's going on in the other parts of the world? The same time period, 3000 BC to 1200 BC, the Bronze Age erupted in Europe and in the Near East. That's very interesting because to make bronze, if you have a bronze weapon and your opponent has, say, stone or flint, well, you're going to beat him because you've got superior weapons technology. And if you've got bronze tools, hardened bronze tools, you've got better tools than anybody else. So bronze was the nuclear fission of its day. Trouble is, in Europe and in the Near East, they don't have much for copper. Very little. And in order to make bronze, you have to have high-grade copper, lots of it, zinc and tin. Well, they had enough zinc over there, and they had tin, but they had very poor amounts of copper. So here you have the Bronze Age erupting in Europe, 3000 BC to 1200 BC, and this great mining enterprise taking place in North America between 3000 BC and 1200 BC. Matter of fact, the Bronze Age ended abruptly 1200 BC, and the copper mining in Isle Royale ended abruptly in 1200 BC. Stopped. Well, in between this, you have Plato, the great Greek philosopher, who tells us that there was this flourishing, very powerful civilization he calls Atlantis. And he says they were very powerful because he characterizes them as copper miners. that they had a monopoly on something called Ori Chalcum. And Ori Chalcum, he describes as the meat of their economy. Ori Chalcum in English means high-grade gold-like copper, very highest-grade copper. So they were copper miners. So it's interesting, you have these three very...
No, I never came across that passage, you know, that he said that they were copper miners.
Oh, sure. Go into the Critias. And he says that he refers to them that they were... they sheeted their walls with ori chalcum, something that you cannot get anymore. Well, I couldn't get it in Plato's day because they didn't know how to get across the Atlantic. They forgot all that. The Atlanteans were noted for being outstanding seafarers and copper miners. Well, anyway, to answer your question, how does this fit in with between Atlantis and Wisconsin? The mining that took place up at Isle Royale took place in a part of the world where the winters were very severe and closed in very quickly. So the mines had, you had a mining season that was really very short. You could only begin mining there, say, in late May, and you had to be out of there by September. And you're bringing all this raw copper out of there. You're not processing. You're bringing it all, and you've got to bring it to some place where you can store it for a while and prepare it for shipment. And there is a place like that in Wisconsin. It's called Rock Lake. Now, Rock Lake is an interesting place because not only are there these structures that are under the water now, but nearby is a place called Aztalan. It's only 3 miles away. And we do know that Aztalan was used for, one of the things was a copper processing plant. They had a huge area in the middle of the city that they built there where archaeologists have found a place for storage of copper. And they know that all the copper is gone, but the stain left, the green stain by the copper is was found. Interestingly enough, Aztalan and Rock Lake are right below the right south of the hard snow line. So that's a place where you would go. The other thing is that one of the burials that was found at Rock Lake, around the edge of Rock Lake, was of a copper miner. There have actually been several. We know that he was a copper miner because he was interred with his copper mining tools, and one of the tools he had was of diorite. Rock Lake originally, when the pioneers found it, was completely surrounded by thousands upon thousands of burials. Rock Lake was used as a necropolis, as a city of the dead. People buried their dead around that lake. And, of course, they've all been plowed over since, you know, development and so on took care of that. But the thesis of my book, Atlantis in Wisconsin, is that the copper miners, the Atlantean copper miners, when they extracted their very valuable copper from Isle Royale and places like that, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, they brought it to Rock Lake, Aztalan, and there they processed it for shipment overseas.
And they took it, what, down the Fox River?
One thing we have to understand is that the river systems that we know today are radically different than the river systems of the, not even the recent past. North America has extremely dynamic geology. And that the river systems of North America were far more navigable than they are today. So it's, we don't know exactly how, but it would have been extremely easy, much easier, to make overland river crossings, even hundreds of years ago, than it is today. Part of course, the change is due to the damming that's been done.
They also did artificial canals, right? Man-made canals?
Right, there's a possibility that they ran a small canal from Aztalan all the way to Rock Lake. That's 3 miles long. That's pretty long. There was talk that it was excavated by a fellow whose name I cannot remember. I can't recall. It's in my book. And then there was some aerial photography that was made about 15 years ago that it would appear that that canal has been found. So it's possible. But they were not interested in really building canals or anything like that here in North America. The only thing they were interested in, the Atlanteans were interested in, was getting that copper out of here as quickly as possible and back to their middlemen in Atlantis, and then they could then bargain and sell that all to all the great kingdoms of the ancient world who were more than willing to pay for this great copper.
Now, a lot of it was shipped down to Poverty Point?
Yes. It looks as though the passage was from... Isle Royale, Upper Michigan, down to Rock Lake, where it was more or less stored for a while during the hard winter season, and then it was sent down to Poverty Point. Poverty Point is in northeastern Louisiana. If there's ever evidence of Atlantis in Atlantean technology and culture in North America, that's got to be at Poverty Point. It's a magnificent ruin which you can visit today. It's an archaeological park, and it's the oldest city in North America. It goes back to 1,500 years before Christ, right at the height of the copper mining time, by the way, and experienced a major population surge in 1200 BC, which is interesting because that's the final destruction of Atlantis. It's the end of the Bronze Age.
At what period?
1200 BC.
1200, okay.
And Poverty Point was a major city, a large city. We're talking about at least 20,000 people, probably much larger than that, whereas Aztalan was probably half that size at its largest. So Aztalan was kind of a clearinghouse, and Poverty Point, further down in the northeastern part of Louisiana, that was like a final stage. That was an actual, it would appear to be a kind of almost a colony that the Atlanteans set up here. The reason why we say that Poverty Point is associated with Atlantis is because the sacred numerals that Plato tells us were involved in Atlantis, the numbers 5 and 6, associated in its architecture, are repeated at Poverty Point, and Poverty Point physically resembles Plato's description of Atlantis as this great concentric arrangement of rings, land rings, and canals. There are your canals you're mentioning, water courses or moats. Atlantis was an unusual city. It was, if you would see it from high in the air, it would appear to be like a great target in which there is concentric arrangement of land, islands, as it were, ringed islands, land rings, separated by great moats of water. And that's exactly the way Poverty Point is. It's a very unique city. There's no other city like that, really, in the world, except in Plato's description of Atlantis.
I have to check that out. You know what would be really interesting? If a person could just map out the exact route that the mound builders or the Atlanteans took from the Great Lake region all the way down to Poverty Point, and then be able to do bus tours, taking people to the various sites.
It would be wonderful. Good, but there's not all that much left.
I know,
and
unfortunately.
Poverty Point certainly still exists. It is possible, I think. There was another site along the way. It's called Cahokia, and that is across the Mississippi River from St. Louis, Missouri. That's, of course, a much later structure, although it appears that there were earlier things going on there. You mentioned about Wisconsin. Wisconsin has a very unique mound. It's the only mound of the 10,000 that T.S. Lewis surveyed. There's only one like this. It's called the Sinisippi Cross. And the Sinisippi Cross is right at the base of Lake Sinisippi today, where it is today. And the cross no longer exists. It was literally plowed out of existence in front of the gaze of T.S. Lewis after he had finished it. And it was a remarkable structure. It was a beautiful, like a compass cross. And that makes a great deal of sense because we determined that the location of this cross at Sinisippi is exactly at the midpoint between Cahokia in central Illinois and the copper mining at Isle Royale. It's exactly midpoint. So it's as though the copper miners would have gone from Cahokia straight on up to Sinisippi. When they got to there, they'd realize they're halfway home. Sinisippi, by the way, is not really a lake. An extension of the Rock River, and in ancient times that river would have gone directly north. You could have sailed straight up to Isle Royale. Can't do that today.
Okay, there it is, right there then.
So Sinisippi, now kind of interesting too, this is off the beaten track, but Sinisippi has been a site for UFO sightings, and what's interesting is that there's at least two occasions that I know of where UFOs have hovered over this area of Sinisippi, exactly where this cross used to be.
You know, I almost think about too. I know that you're using that as a compass or a directive right there, but it also kind of strikes me that it could possibly be the marking of two major ley lines.
Might be.
And that might be what pulls those UFOs too.
Well,
and of course the rivers would follow the ley lines.
I can't second guess what that is, you know. But it is interesting when I read in the papers that there had been this rash of UFO sightings around 97, I think it was, and they pinpointed just where it was, and that I was really surprised to see that there had been repeated sightings of it over of these discs directly over where the cross used to be. So maybe the cross, as you say, was there marking something more than just direction.
Well, it seems like there's so many things that interconnect.
Right, exactly.
And I think that's, you know, it's like what you had earlier said. This is the problem with archaeologists. They focus on one thing. And when you're dealing with, you know, the mound builders and all the things that go with this, you know, because, of course, you have this, the shaman energies, the copper, the... There's so much the documentation of the land by using, you know, by actually drawing on the land like the land was a huge canvas.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, they used it for a religious ceremony, maybe some sort of who knows if they were a major ley lines there. It could be, you know, creating vortexes, you
yes,
know, where
yes, yes.
you know there's openings openings into the other dimensions, the other other times, you know, maybe time travel. Who knows yet? You know, we're just starting to touch the surface of all the information that has been lost to us.
These effigy mounds appear to represent the type of energy that was perceived at a specific place.
Yeah.
So if you had, say, for example, a panther mound at some spot, that's because the shaman involved intuited or knew somehow that the energy there had something that characterized itself like a puma or a cat of some kind or a bird. These things were not done randomly. The exact same type of psychic, if you want to put it, was known in ancient Europe as a geomancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the Greek, meaning knower of the earth, geo, earth, and maser, master of the earth. And the geomancer was also a kind of a reader of the landscape, and who knew about sacred sites. That's why temples and shrines were made where they were. They weren't made just randomly. They were made specifically because they reflected something in the environment.
Well, that's a lot of people come to me and they'll say, well, Mary, how do you find these PowerPoints? And I say, it's simple. You look for the mounds.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
that's right.
Once you learn that little trick, you know, then it's just
yeah.
a, you know. Well, Burlington has a serpent mound. I never had a chance to show you the serpent mound. It's actually right where the river is there, right behind, you know, where the... right behind the Sci-Fi Cafe where you guys did your lectures in October. So we'll be going there, and I'll be able to show you. You can walk right by it and not notice it because it's overgrown, but
uh-huh.
it's still there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be remarkable if it's there, because there are very few serpent mounds in North America. Very few.
Yeah, I think that this one I actually found a map of it through the Smithsonian. I think, who was that work? Lapham's work, I think, was it?
Increase Lapham, oh,
yeah,
isn't that wonderful. Yeah, they named, of course, that park, that whole park after him.
Yeah, and so anyhow, he was, I believe it was him that marked the Serpent Mound there.
Oh, well,
yeah. It's where the Rock River and because, see, there's two rivers that come together here in Burlington. The Fox with the White River. And one runs north to south, and the other runs south to north. So, which is quite interesting, because that doesn't supposed to be like that.
Well, I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, so anyhow, we got that, and then we also have the panther right outside of Burlington. Oh, well, you're going to in June. That's what could be part of the expedition.
Well, I'm a student of all this stuff. I have everything to learn.
Well, that's the makings of a good teacher, right?
Well, I don't know if I have to teach anything. I'm excited about this stuff, and it's great to be able to share it with people. And you know, whatever they can add to it or point out my errors in it, that's great.
Well, you know, the thing is, I doubt, you know, it's like we're all theorizing on who these people were, and sometimes our theories may not quite agree with the others, but we're still keeping an open mind enough where we're still going forward. I think I think what happens where it becomes detrimental is when we become so close-minded to one particular theory that we can't see everything else that's going on.
Well, that's human nature.
Yeah, yeah. But I we're getting close. My objective here is to give these people back their names.
That's got to be rough.
Yeah, it is.
Like impossible, really.
It really is. We're getting, it's opening. But Wisconsin was, and we talked about this before, I believe, Wisconsin always seemed to me as like a veiled state.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, you know, even here in North America, I mean, most of the archaeology is focused in Europe, in Africa, Australia, in the Middle East. It seems like the archaeologists don't really dedicate very much time to North America as
no.
it is. And especially to the writings that they come across, they don't seem to even want to interpret you know what they're saying, but they'll spend a lifetime trying to decipher some sort of language that they may find in any other country. It's just like to decipher the language that has been that we have found in the artifacts here in North America is like it's taboo to the archaeologists.
No, you're 100% right. American archaeology is really benighted. It's
yeah.
really behind the times.
And the little that we do have, nothing really. Wisconsin seems to be the least focused on, and it should be the most focused on.
It's
one of the more important ones, I should say.
Yeah, it really is. I just finished a book. It won't be out till next year, and it's called Advanced Civilizations of Prehistoric America. And the book deals at length with Wisconsin, focuses on a lot of the things we're talking about here. And it's a huge chapter of our prehistory, and it's not taught in the schools. You won't see it discussed on TV. It's just dismissed as, just neglected to death. It's just pathetic. Wisconsin is uncommonly rich in a very fascinating prehistory. Great things took place here. The mystery is very deep. There was obviously a very populous people that were living here, a state of some kind. These were highly advanced people. They did great work, and they vanished. They vanished away. And see, the tragedy of history is that subsequent generations, they never learn from it. They're just like children, you know. They don't learn from mistakes. You know, why did this civilization rise so high right here, and why did it vanish? What happened?
And why is the and another important question, why the big cover up? Why aren't these especially local archaeologists, why aren't they dedicating as much time to this as you are and I am? I mean,
I think they probably are dedicating probably more time to it than we are, but it's very narrow and they're just going over the same ground. I work for a magazine called Ancient American. And at the offices of Ancient American in with Colfax, Wisconsin, they have quite a magnificent library. And this library is magnificent because it contains a large number of old archaeological books, long out of print. And these were books that were written by people who were pioneers. Came along with the pioneer, or shortly after the pioneers, just when all this material was new and fresh. And the stuff that they found, the artifacts they found, are astounding. And yet they're dismissed today as unimportant. I mean, not just the artifacts, but I mean, all of the so-called antiquarians from that time are just literally laughed into non-existence by the current archaeologists who only believe their own work, and they cut themselves off completely from all of the really important work that took place in the 19th century. And I think that's it just shows you an indication of how benighted this science has become. You know, and that's why it's not making any progress, and it's just going over the same old ground that it has for about the past 70 or 80 years. You know, you pick up a textbook about ancient Wisconsin 1940, it's exactly the same as anything today you might find. The few that you do find.
Oh, but the world, my gosh, when we finally discover or recognize what Wisconsin has, the world is going to open up to the people here in Wisconsin. I mean, history to me is I love history, you know, true history, that is. And
living history.
Yes, and I mean, because it's a whole new world for these people, a world of mysticism of
right.
wonder, of, you know, this ancient, lost, forgotten race that was right here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, in the 1800s, people were able to just walk through and pick up all the stuff, but there's still things yet to be found, you know. People should still be able to go out there and walk around, and if they knew what they were looking for and how to look for it, you know, they could still find some very interesting things. Brad, as a matter of fact, you're my husband, you know him, Frank, but for the listeners, he was in Twin Lakes. That's only about 20 minutes away from Burlington, and he looked down and he found some, or so he thought, he found some rocks that he felt was kind of interesting, so he picked them up and he put them in his pocket, and I don't know how, this guy is so lucky when it comes to finding things, you know, it's just, it amazes
some
me.
Some people gotta talk.
Yeah, he found an ancient, it's a sculptured stone. It's a black stone. It's been cut, and it's got on the face of it a frog.
Oh my gosh!
You know, and then like a lily pad underneath of it.
Oh my!
But I mean, it's, you know, it's like a black onyx maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But there that was, and I mean, almost in pristine condition. But besides that, he found an ancient coin, a copper coin, you know, that has to go back 1200 BC, 1500 BC, something like that. But I mean, and the reason I recognized it is because I happened to have an identical coin in my museum.
Oh my.
That I had under glass. And so he came to me and he says, "Well, what's this?" And I says, "Where did you find that?" But I mean, that was just on the surface. So things are starting to come back up to it's working back up to the surface.
Oh, sure.
You know, but most people, they don't look down. And if they did look down, they don't know what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is one of the reasons that I wanted to do this this June event.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to do it on a yearly type of event, an annual thing, and have you come every year. Because I want to start teaching people how to look for things again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people can't afford to go to college and learn how to be, and if they could afford it, they got a family, you know, they got a support, you know. They can't just go off to be an archaeologist, you know.
No.
They have responsibilities at
but
home.
The great discoveries are made by amateurs.
Well, sure they are. But so I'm hoping that what we're going to do in June, you could teach these people what to look for as they're walking through these areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how to look for it, how to look at a stone, how to look at the lands, how to see these burls, you know. What is a rock mound, you know? What's the significance, you know, to all of this, and how the waterways run, you know, and how to look for a mound, you know. You know, things like that, you know, that's not really taught in school. You know?
No, it isn't.
And I mean, you know, I mean, they may not, they may not end up with a PhD or anything behind their name, but at least it will give them something that they've never had an opportunity to ever have before. That you will be giving them in June. And
well,
we thank you for that.
Give them tips.
Well, a few tips sometimes. You know, to some, a few tips is nothing. To a person that goes to college, you know, and, you know, they're going to be an archaeologist, a few tips, well, what's that? But for some people, you know, they're hungry for that information. And that information just isn't out there for them. So those few little tips, you know, to them, you know, is worth, you know, a sack full of gold. I know it is for me. You know, listen, you know, just what you're talking about tonight, I mean, it to me is very, very valuable information, you know. And
well, I'm just passing along what I picked up, that's all.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what it's all about, isn't it? It's passing along.
Yeah, sharing all
because,
that.
Because most what happens today is most of that information never gets passed along.
No, that's the tragedy of it. Most people have no idea how valuable their state is.
Absolutely not. And this way, you know, people can go out on their land and walk around and, like Brad, just happen to look down and pick up a few rocks and gosh only knows what they're going to find.
For sure.
You know? And so for everyone that would like to come to our event, it's going to be in Burlington. Frank is going to be there June 20th and 21st. And Peter Moon's going to be there as well. And Peter's going to be coming in to talk more on the Mormon history and how the Mormon history connects to the mound builders and the people that moved from New York or migrated from New York to Wisconsin. So that's going to be interesting. But and Frank's going to be there to talk about what we've been talking about tonight. And then there'll be morning lectures. And then after the lectures, then we start, the afternoon will be starting out with me doing a historical tour around town. And then after that, the first day, we'll be going to the Voorhees, where the first Mormon community had been established and where the Prophet Strang claims to have found the Voorhees plates, which of course there's a lot of controversy over that. But we do know that in that area there was some ancient miners. And we did find the quarry, and we have found where we believe the mine was, what that had been sunk, that pretty much was based off the story of the Voorhees plates. And I'm not going to validate the Voorhees plates, but I do believe that we found the sunken mine and we found the quarry. And we have found rocks with ancient inscriptions. And this is where Frank comes in, and he'll be showing you more on how these quarries work, how, you know, to look for things that, you know, sunk. Because when I learned this, Frank, when I was in Kentucky, I was out there working out, trying to find these ancient temples up in this high mountain area. Mm-hmm. And we were working with some treasure hunters. And the guy told me, one of the treasure hunters says, well, you can, when you're looking for buried treasure, you always find, like, indentations in the ground. Because once the ground has been disturbed and dug up, and then you cover it up again, through time, the top surface will sink. Mm. And it'll leave kind of like a little gully or, you know, like a hole there. And that's what you start looking for. So when we were looking for those, the ancient mines, you know, that that the Voorhees plates talk about that had that they had been working, that's what we were looking for, and we found it, you know, and sure enough, and there's a huge quarry right there as well. So, anyhow, that's how we were managed to find it. But anyhow, we'll be taking you there, and then also the people will be seeing the old Mormon church, and then the where the community was, and then the. The second day, the Sunday, the final day, we're going to be going up into this wooded area that, and Frank, you know the one I'm talking about. Yes. And where we believe that, you want to tell them what you think?
Well, if I remember correctly, of course, I've only visited it once.
And, of course, we don't want to give them out too much information on it.
No, but what's remarkable about what you showed me is that it appears that we're seeing stone mounds. Now, that's kind of interesting because we're told that the another people called the Edina, these were even before the Hopewell. The Edina were builders of stone mounds. The Hopewell were not. The Hopewell do not appear to have built any stone structures at all, none that we know about in any case. But the Edina, who preceded the Hopewell, an earlier people, they did build stone mounds. And these stone mounds were not just heaps of rock. They were used almost exclusively as sepulchers, burial areas. They would build it. First, they'd excavate a trench. They'd dig a trench. They put the deceased in this trench. They put grave goods in with the trench and with the deceased persons. These grave goods would include copper sometimes, because the Edina were involved in copper, use of copper. Sometimes beautifully crafted shirt items, C-H-E-R-T. It's a kind of flint. And sometimes sacrificed to animals, mostly dogs. And then they would heap up stone mounds over the dead and shape them so they would look sort of like elongated tents out of stone. And perhaps they coated them with a kind of plaster. These are the structures, that, by the way, that are found at the bottom of Rock Lake. And it appears, from what I could see, that these structures in Burlington are Edina. Now, some archaeologists will give you a hard time with that because they say, oh, we don't think the Edina ever made it to this part of Wisconsin. Other archaeologists will disagree and say, no, we know for sure that there are some stone mounds further north, as a matter of fact, a place called Butte des Morts, or the Hills of Death, interestingly enough. So I think that what we're looking at, I'd have to see it again. I'm not a professional archaeologist. I have to stress that. I'm an archaeological reporter. I take all of the information that the others have done all the hard work for, and I try to put all this information into a form that average people like myself can understand. I popularize archaeological finds, and I try to make sense out of them. But I do have some experience in all this, in covering all this, and I do have something of an eye for it. You build it up over time. And I believe what you showed me were the remains of an Edina community or a sacred area, a burial area that we're looking at.
Yes, and folks, this is what we're going to be taking you to, and help. And I can't tell you much about it because there's going to be a lot of surprises in hand on that little voyage. But we're looking forward to seeing everyone June 20th and 21st in Burlington, Wisconsin. Now, for information on this, we want you to go to livinginthelightms.com/ancient Wisconsin. Living in the Light, that's the name of my first book. It's an M for Mary, S for Sutherland. So it's livinginthelightms.com/ancient Wisconsin. That will open up a website that will give you the whole itinerary for June 20th and 21st. And you can come in the mornings just to listen to the lectures. Come in the afternoon, you know, to be part of our field trip. However you want to do it. I broke it all down so you know you guys can figure out how you want to spend your day or your weekend. But spending a day with Frank Joseph is, as far as I'm concerned, anyone's dream. You know, so I hope to see you guys there. We're hoping that we'll have a lot of great things to be able to share with everybody after this too, you know, because we want to document a lot of this. Then after that, Frank and I are Lake Mills to do a little expedition of the underwater pyramids of Rock Lake.
That's right. I'm looking forward to that especially.
And Mark's going to be with us. He's got the pontoon, so. And you've got everything else, right?
Well, I hope
so. Divers and everything.
Yeah,
so.
We have some professional divers to come along with. So we're looking for a very specific target. And we're bringing along our underwater cameras, and we hope we can get this thing photographed.
And I'm bringing two videographers, so that we'll be able to document the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, so then that way, like, if we'll have raw material for people that, you know, like television or somebody wants to, popularize our hard work, that'd be okay too, right?
I'm looking forward to the one structure especially is very tempting, and it's in shallow water, and I think we stand a good chance of finding it.
Good. Oh, I know I'm looking forward to that one too. And so anyhow, Frank Joseph, you know, thank you so much for all the hard work that the energies that you have dedicated to preserving the history of ancient America, especially Wisconsin. And I know here in Burlington, you are, you know, in our home, you are very much appreciated.
Well, thank you, Mary.
As well as your lovely wife for standing behind you all this time.
That's right.
Having dragging her around every place.
No, she's my better half. She's my real brain.
Oh, we love her here very much.
Oh, I'll tell her that.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I can't express enough to you my gratitude for making all this possible. You're playing a more of a major role in all this than you probably can appreciate yourself, and you're just doing really great work, and I'm very happy to be associated with you.
Well, thank you so much, Frank. Don't forget to bring me some Ancient American magazines.
All right, I'll see if I can scrounge some up.
And there will be a booth here, a table set up for you, so like if you want to sell some books and things like that, we'll have so anybody that wants to get some of Frank's books, get on down to Burlington at the Sci-Fi Cafe and grab a few books. Frank will be there and his lovely wife, Laura, and get and Frank will autograph his books for you. Okay? So, again, we'll see you June 20th and 21st.
Looking forward to it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Night.